League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Jackson with a drive to deep right field. Joyce back. It's over his head and it's gone. Austin Jackson with an opposite field home run. His second homer of the year. And it gives the Indians a 1-0 lead. That is hammered. Goodbye. Deep into the seats in right field. And the Indians lead is 2-0. Home run number 6 for Carlos Santana. And this ball's hit hard. Deep center. Back is Rajay. He's out of room. It's out of here. Way out of here. Up into Heritage Park. Encarnacion home run number 10. And he's now hit in 8 straight.
And we talk so much about putting up a crooked number. It was 4, but I mean, it's those things are good. We see what happened. They hit 3 solos, but it wasn't enough. Now it got interesting at the end, but it wasn't enough. But we did some good things early.
There's a ground ball, fair ball inside the bag at third. 2 runs will score. Iglesias and Avila have come in. It's going to be a double and 2 RBIs for Victor Martinez. Swinging a drive into deep left field, way back and gone. J.D. Martinez, a 3-run shot for the Tigers. And the offense has exploded here in the 5th. And it's going to get through. Here comes the runner of the plate. Throw, time, not a tie. Tigers have the lead. Here's the base hit to center field. 1 run scores. Here comes Iglesias to the plate. The throw, the tag, safe. A 2-run single for Miguel Cabrera.
A little bit of a roller coaster, but I think it was nice to see the bats perk up. A lot of guys up and down the line came up with some big hits. JD, Miggy, Presley, Iglesias, and get that all part of that rally. Justin Upton, get that thing going. So that was the real bright spot was the offense perking up.
Whoa! History. And Bryce Harper wants a piece of Hunter Strickland. Here they go. Strickland lands a punch. Harper lands a punch. Bench is empty. And if that was unintentional, Hunter Strickland just totally lost his command.
We told you there was history. And that goes back to the playoffs a couple of years ago, and that was intentional in my mind.
Middle of the back with the hardest fastball he has.
I understand there are ways to police the game, but an egregious act like this where some guy hits 2 home runs off me and I don't think I can get him out, so I'm just going to throw 98 at his hip. Why is this allowed? This isn't allowed in any other sport. Yeah, 20 games, unpaid, get into his wallet, and I think stuff like this will stop happening.
The police report, according to what Tiger Woods has told them, names 4 different medications that Tiger Woods said he is currently on, all prescription medications. So, again, that certainly paints a harrowing picture of what Tiger Woods was doing that night and where he was going. We still don't know that. That is still unconfirmed. But according to the report, as I said, very slow, very sluggish, slurred speech, and simple field sobriety tests. He was not able to pass those. So that is why he was arrested and brought in that night.
What really resonates and is really vexing and should be vexing to us all was how the guy was essentially living the life of a complete phony and got exposed. You went about the business of making yourself into a billionaire because you marketed yourself as the wholesome family guy, you know, with the beautiful wife, the beautiful home, the beautiful game itself, and the beautiful image. It was meticulously and carefully crafted to manipulate the masses.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
What's going on? Welcome to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. It's 14 minutes after 3. Got an outstanding program lined up for you. You're going to talk in the second hour of the show. Coming up at about 4, we'll call it 4:10 after the montage. We're going to talk with Bill Connolly, who writes for SB Nation College Football. Really, really deep researched piece. All opinion, but based in deep research on how to fix college football by way of having a commissioner appointed. And he, of course, would be that commissioner. I mean, really, really deep, long. I mean, you could tell he's probably putting months and months into this. The student-athlete Bill of Rights, how to modernize amateurism, fixing recruiting, promotion and relegation, expanding the playoffs, fixing scheduling and scrapping divisions. I mean, just every possible topic that every sports talk show host in America has covered on college football in the last 30 years, probably he addresses on how to fix those things, which makes it really, really great fodder for a sports talk show conversation. So I'm really looking forward to talking to Bill Connelly at 4:10. Even though it's not college football season, we're waiting for the NBA Finals to start. Last night, the NHL Finals started for those who were watching, and I know there aren't that many, but for those who were watching, the NHL Finals got underway. P.K. Subban got hosed on the first goal of the game, and the Preds really, well, I can't say they never recovered. They recovered enough to tie the game going into the third, or in the third, but obviously it was a Penguins round one, or game one victory, I should say. So you got the NHL Finals going on. Baseball is in full, matter of fact, not only is it really in full effect, we're past Memorial Day now. And when you pass Memorial Day, that's kind of that benchmark that most people kind of go with as far as deciding who you are and what you're going to be. That if you're really, really good before Memorial Day, it could be dismissed as a hot start. If you're really, really bad and underperforming before Memorial Day, it could be just dismissed as a slow start. But once you get to about Memorial Day, yeah, that's pretty much who you are. This is what you're going to be for the season. And the Indians, by virtue of a couple of wins in their last two, are 26 and 23. Translating that out, they're going to be a plus, around 10, 12 in the win-loss column, which is going to be good for 90-plus victories and probably a shot at a division championship, but not going to run away with anything because it's only three games over 500 through these first 49 games. Tigers, three games under 500. If you kind of prorate that out a little bit again and extend it, going to finish 10, 12, 13 maybe games to the bad over the course of the next what do we got left from 90 games, or actually 100 games, because we're about 50 in, 110 games. So kind of protract that out to the 162. It's a team that's not going to be there, at least when it comes time to the playoffs, as is anyway, barring some significant changes. Tigers have lost 7 of their last 10. Indians have won 6 of their last 10. And that's all we're really paying attention to. The Twins, even though I just kind of laid it out, are the Twins really going to be there? You know, based on their Memorial Day record of 26 and 21, are they really going to be the team? I don't think so. I just don't think they have the depth. I don't think they have the staying power or the talent. I think they're playing over their heads even past Memorial Day. So just a little thought on the baseball world. You heard a little bit of the montage there. We'll come back to baseball and the Bryce Harper, Hunter Strickland story here in just a couple of minutes. Matter of fact, really, really quickly. But I'm going to start this afternoon, first of all, by welcoming you to the program. You can join the program more personally, if you are so inclined, by dialing 866-240-1065, and we'll take your phone calls. Frank Gargano, Jim Cushlin are both here as well. We'll talk to them in a few. But I got to start with the Tiger Woods story that we wrapped up the montage with. You heard a little bit from Jason Sobel and then from Stephen A. Smith, who came down awfully hard on Tiger Woods. And maybe coming down awfully hard on Tiger Woods is what's required here. Yet there's a part of me that, for whatever reason, is feeling very, very empathetic, very, very sympathetic, very, very bad for Tiger Woods. There's a part of me that feels like we should probably lighten up just a little bit, take a couple of steps back, and maybe lay the hell off of the guy. Now, why? You're probably thinking to yourself. He brought this on himself. He had the world by the you-know-whats. He was worth, $100 million, $200 million, 14-time major champion, 90 career victories or whatever the number is. The guy had the world. He had it all. Fame, fortune, success, trophies, a trophy wife. Not that you should look at women as trophies, but you understand that phrase. Gorgeous, beautiful wife that any man would love to have on his arm. Wonderful children. He had it all. And then he decided that he didn't have enough. And he decided that he had some sort of sexual addiction that made him cheat on that gorgeous wife and put everything that he had built in grave jeopardy about 10 years ago. We know how it went down. Since then, over the last four, Tiger has been trying to come back, not from that. He kind of came back from that because time always heals all wounds. Eventually, people kind of forget about that sort of thing unless something else sordid happens. And it's just about golf. But he hadn't been able to golf consistently for the last 4 years because of injury after injury after injury. Back injury, back surgery, complications from back surgeries, knee surgeries. He's had so many different things go wrong with his body. He hasn't been able to do what he loves, which is golf. And where does it all end up? It ends up with that mugshot that's going to kind of go down probably in infamy for many years to come. Maybe with the Nick Nolte mugshot. That's a pretty famous one, or infamous one, if you ever remember Nick Nolte, the great actor from Blue Chips and from 48 Hours and Cape Fear, and one of my favorite guys, to be honest with you. One of my favorite actors of all time. But he had a bender slash drug thing or whatever it was where he was arrested and he just looked like he woke up under a bridge. One of those famous mugshots, infamous mugshots of an unshaven, unkempt, completely slitty-eyed, obviously whacked out on something, Tiger Woods, found asleep at the wheel of his car in Jupiter, Florida. Arrested on suspicion of DUI. You got to be very careful with DUI, driving under the influence, or OVI, operating a vehicle under the influence of something. But it wasn't alcohol. We know that Tiger Woods did, or early reports were very, very bad. Early reports were what President Trump would call fake news, because they were reporting, one of the officers smelled alcohol on his breath. There's no alcohol. One of the officers reported, or at least the news reports were, and I don't know if they got from the officers or whatever the case might be, was he was belligerent and arrogant and refused breathalyzers. No, he did submit to the breathalyzer, not once but twice, and blew .000 both times. He was not drinking, but he was sleeping. He was sleeping at the wheel of his car. He was disoriented, didn't know where he was. First told the officers that he was driving home from California after playing golf. Mind you, he's in Florida. That's one hell of a drive. That would make one tired, might make one fall asleep at the wheel. But it wouldn't make one unable, it would seem to think, to fail not one, not two, not three, but four different field sobriety tests. He could not pass the field sobriety tests. And when you add all of those things together, there was definitely something that was impairing and impacting Tiger Woods. Wasn't that alcohol? Come to find out, according to the reports now, he was on four different prescription drugs. Solasex, and I'm being very careful on this because I'm not sure how to pronounce this, and I've seen it spelled two different ways. But it's S-O-L-O-X-E-X is how the first report that I got of the spelling of it was. So I'm not sure exactly what that particular drug is. Vicodin, we know what that is. That's an opioid. That's an opioid. That's a pain-killing drug. Torix and Vioxx. Those are the ones that he was reportedly on. He released a statement, as you know, late yesterday, saying alcohol was not a factor in his arrest. And that's the instant denial that everybody does whenever they get pulled over for DUI. No, it wasn't alcohol. And then come to, especially if you don't blow into the breathalyzer, come to find out later on, maybe it was. But he was telling the truth. It was not alcohol. Usually guys will say it's not alcohol. It was a strange reaction to some medicine I was taking. I believe Josh Gordon. Didn't Josh Gordon try to pass off one of his positive drug tests in the midst of his ongoing football drug program saga by saying, no, it was a medication that I took with some cough syrup that caused this positive test for alcohol or some other banned substance. Everybody tries to do the medicine thing. But it looks like in this case there might be something to it. And that's why there's a part of me, maybe only a small part of me, but maybe it's growing, that isn't laughing at Tiger Woods, isn't angry with Tiger Woods, is a little bit disappointed in Tiger Woods and is a whole lot sad for Tiger Woods. I'm very, very sad for Tiger Woods right now. I understand the severity of what I did, he wrote in a statement, and I take full responsibility for my actions. I want the public to know that alcohol was not involved. What happened was an unexpected reaction to prescribed medications. I didn't realize the mix of medications had affected me so strongly. Doesn't explain why he was out on the road at about 2:30 in the morning. Did he take the drugs while driving? When I say the drugs, again, let's point out these are prescription. This isn't like he went and scored cocaine or something like that. Did he take his prescribed drugs while driving? Did he take them at home for whatever purpose or whatever indicated use that he has for them and then have them come together in his system, making him not realize what he was doing and not realize that he was in such an impaired state? Has he been taking all four of those drugs together for a long time? If the answer to that part of this equation is yes, then you could say, well, he should have known what it does to him, that it impairs him. If this is a new prescription, even if one or two of the prescriptions are new, and he did not grasp, perhaps with the assistance of his doctor or pharmacist, that you can't take this one with this one, those kinds of things, and didn't know that it would react the way that it did in his system. And then he thought it was okay wherever he might have been going at 2 o'clock in the morning. But he didn't know that he was going to be as messed up. That changes the narrative. Very, very different than drinking alcohol, which you know is going to impair you. Tiger Woods, it would appear, based on what we know, and based also a lot on what we suspect, because there is much we don't know, quite obviously. There's much we don't know. But it would appear that Tiger Woods needs a lot of help. It would appear that whether it's physical help with addiction, or let me rephrase, help with physical addiction, or maybe he needs some psychological counseling, maybe a combination of both of those things. But Tiger Woods is in really, really grave need of help. It would appear as though he may have an addiction to some of these painkilling drugs. And again, not being a doctor, I don't know what all of those drugs do. And if somebody does, dial me, please. Tell me what all of those drugs do. I really don't know. I just know that the one that Vicodin, of course, is a painkiller. Not really certain about the others. Why he's taking those. My feeling of empathy for him that I kind of expressed at the start of this monologue comes from the knowledge that he is trying to get back to golfing. And with the back problems he has, anybody who swings a club knows the incredible strain you put on your own back when you swing a golf club. It's a total core sport. It's all about your core. And if your core, your trunk of your body, is jacked up, and his is because of multiple surgeries, the pain that might come with trying to swing that club is probably extraordinary. I once swung a golf club when I had I still have the very slight tear to a disc in my lower lumbar region of my back, and when it inflames and catches the vertebra in just the wrong way, and it inflames and it locks you up, it's like, oh my God, swinging the club makes it feel like 1,000 arrows just shot you in the back. I mean, at the same time, it's terrible. That's one tiny little thing. He's had multiple surgeries. He may be in a lot of pain a lot of the time. As such, he may very well be taking a lot of painkillers and other things, muscle relaxers, etc., to try to deal with that, and he may have indeed become addicted to them. And that's the reason for a large part of me not being angry at him, and certainly not laughing at his funny mugshot, because, oh, look at Tiger Woods. But just makes me feel very sorry for him, very, very sad for him. It's entirely possible, since he's not, to our knowledge, anyway, a drinker, or at least much of one. He certainly wasn't drinking in this case. If he is on pills, if he is on prescription medications, which we know have led, particularly the painkillers, the opioids, have led to the terrible heroin addiction problem that continues to plague this country and is only getting worse. As people start by taking prescribed medicines like this, then their body becomes physically addicted to them, and then they can't get them anymore because the doctor shuts them off, and that's when they turn to the street versions, often much cheaper in the form of heroin. We know the story now. If Tiger Woods is dealing with something like that, not the heroin part, just the addiction to these opioids or to these pain-killing drugs, he needs a lot more than just, you know, he's going to need full-on psychological counseling. He's going to need full-on 12-step, what's the word, intercession. Well, yeah, I guess intercession, we could say that. Somebody has to intercede, and somebody needs to get him. You know who's looking to help? Jack Nicklaus. The man that Tiger had been chasing for the last 20 years and his 18 majors, got within four when it all came kind of crashing down, and we all know now that it'll never happen. Jack Nicklaus expressing great concern for Tiger Woods today. "I feel bad for Tiger," said Jack Nicklaus, the greatest of all time. "Tiger's a friend. He's been great for the game of golf. He needs our help, and I wish him well." He's right. Tiger Woods needs help. And so because of that, there's a part of me that is, there's part of me that can't forgive him getting behind the wheel when he has been taking these drugs. I just need the rest of the story. I need to know, did he just recently start one or two of those and not know how much they were going to impact him together? In which case, maybe he can be excused somewhat for the decision to get behind the wheel and then again be passing out at, fast asleep in his car at 2:00 in the morning or 2:30 in the morning. If that's the case, it's different. But if he did know, if he has been taking these a while and he did know how much these things can mess him up, I cannot forgive him going out onto the roads, because even late at night, while the traffic won't be very heavy, there may be a car on the road, any other car, that he might lose control and steer into as he falls asleep and passes out and putting other people in harm's way. I cannot forgive that. But for now, based on what we know and what we suspect, I have a lot of empathy and a lot of sadness for Tiger Woods. I'm not going to laugh, not going to rant. And I've ranted at other guys who can't put down drugs, who can't get control of their own personal habits because it's affecting their professional lives in the sports world, you know, the players. I've gone off on people before, and there may be a time when I've got to go off on Tiger on this once I find out that, no, this is not the real story, here's the real story, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, we all reserve the right to change our minds once the circumstances that we based our decisions on change. But for now, I heard that story yesterday, and I felt bad. And when I read about it this morning, that it was not alcohol at all, that he blew 0-0-0, that he was not confrontational, was not arrogant, was just lost, had no idea where he was, I feel very, very bad for a man who once provided us with so much entertainment, so much excitement on the golf course, made golf fans out of golf haters, made passionate golf fans out of casual ones. He did that. He brought the game so much more exposure than it ever had before, even better than when Jack and Arnie and Watson and Gary Player and all the others were doing their thing. He changed it in so many ways. We owe him that debt of thanks. And I think we owe, at least for now, a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. And that's what I'm going to offer Tiger Woods. Watch your thoughts on it at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Going to take a timeout now for a bottom of the hour sports center, but not before I hook you up. Are you ready for a sweet deal of the week already this early in the week? That's right. 6-pack of tickets to Break Room, to the Break Room at Splash Universe in Dundee. Log on to 1065theticket.com tomorrow morning. That's Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. for a $100 value 6-pack of tickets to the Break Room at Splash Universe for just $35. Or be the fifth caller right now to 866-240-1065, and we'll give you the freebie. That's right. The 6-pack of tickets valued at $100 for nothing. If you are the fifth caller right now at 866-240-1065, and we're right back after.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Indeed, as we roll onward, thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations to Eric Jelaski of Maumee. Eric was paying attention and was indeed the fifth caller that we asked for, and he has got tickets to the Splash Universe Water Park in Dundee. So congratulations to him. Okay. My diatribe about Tiger Woods is over. Jim Cushlin, Frank Gargano, before we get into the Bryce Harper, Hunter Strickland story, which is another one that is I have equally strong opinions about, but these are very different. These ones are angry.
Sure.
Because I want Hunter Strickland suspended for a year. I know it won't happen. At the very bare minimum, I want him suspended for 25 games, which would be five starts, because this is ridiculous. But I wanted to get your reaction, guys, to the Tiger Woods story. When I heard yesterday he got a DUI, I thought, oh, my God, here we go again. He's just completely destroying his career. He'll never come back. And I thought DUI, driving under the influence of alcohol.
Right, as did I when I first read it, yep.
Yeah. Come to find out, though, as I explained in the first hour, or excuse me, half hour of the program, it wasn't alcohol. It was indeed a mixture of four different prescription drugs. And it changed it a little bit, and now I start thinking, why is he on these? And then I'm thinking, well, of course we know why he's on these. He has been just a physical nightmare in the last 4 years, surgery after surgery and rehab after rehab. He's probably in so much pain. He's taking a lot of things he probably ended up getting hooked on and then made the wrong decision to get behind the wheel of a car. I put a poll question up. As a matter of fact, it's right now up at our Twitter page, which is 1065, or excuse me, Sports Radio 1065, Sports Radio 1065 on Twitter. And the question is, when you see an all-time legend like Tiger Woods fall to depths such as this, how does it make you feel? Sad, angry, disappointed, or funny? Like, are you laughing at his, you know, his misery? My answer is the first one right now. It's sad. What's yours?
I'm going to go with number three right now, disappointed, because I kind of had the same take as you did. I'm first reading this about this when it came out first yesterday, thinking, oh, good Lord. First time I hear Tiger Woods' name, it feels like in a couple of months that this is what I hear. Then, of course, we get the more evidence out that, no, it's not actually DUI. A whole bunch of these different meds and things caused him to be behind the wheel, which he shouldn't have been, not know where he is. So it moved from me thinking, oh, good, you know, good job, Tiger. Way to keep messing yourself up to... Now I feel a little disappointed and bad for a little bit bad for the guy, kind of like you were explaining in that first segment, especially when more of the evidence of what exactly happened came out. So I'm kind of more in the just disappointed. Just again, it's for me, it's disappointed because look, I understand apparently he didn't really know where he was at, you know, when he's on all these things, but he still did at some point during all that got behind the wheel, even if he didn't drive anywhere and fall asleep, and that's just not good. You can't be doing that,
Frank.
Sad. You know, Bob, we did a fun little segment the other week about our favorite athletes for each sport, and you brought up golf and the admiration, Tiger Woods. Nothing got me more pumped up about golf than seeing Tiger Woods in his signature red on Sunday doing the fist pump.
Right?
Like, that guy did so much for the sport of golf, especially for me, you know, growing up. I gave a damn about professional golf because Tiger Woods was exciting. He was a great player. I don't know all the specifics, as neither does everybody else. I don't know. Like he said, he could have had just a bad reaction to it. The disappointing part was that he was behind the wheel.
Yeah. And as I said in my commentary, I want to know the circumstances behind the ingestion of those particular prescriptions. If he had been taking, let's say, two of them, and he knows that he's fine and he can go out and drive and nothing will inhibit, and has recently begun taking the others, and has not yet taken them together, or maybe only on one or two occasions has, and didn't know that it would impact him in such a deep way. And clearly it did, because he again fell asleep. First of all, I'd call that passing out at the wheel. Second of all, he didn't know where he was. He told the story, the officers, he was coming back from golfing in California, and then he asked the officers how far he was from his house when the direction of his car was traveling away from his house, as if he had just left. So he was clearly in an impaired state of mind for one reason or another. So what I want to know is, how irresponsible was it to take those drugs and then go driving? If he had been taking those drugs on a regular basis, he should damn well have known. and from his doctor and his pharmacist, who should tell him, don't take this with this or this with this or all four of them at the same time, or else this is going to be the, you know, what happens to you. Do you know the old do not operate heavy machinery under the influence of any of these drugs? Then you really have to hold him responsible for not thinking it through before he goes and gets into it behind the wheel. But if this was all new, or a vast majority or even part of this was new, and he had had these drugs before, prescription drugs, I want to keep saying that word so people don't think we're talking about illicit substances, but if he had had them before and been fine, and now suddenly a new one is introduced to the mix, and that's the one that puts him over the edge, then you have a little bit of room for leeway as far as, you know, how much blame should there be in his decision, if you want to call it a decision, to get behind the wheel in an impaired state.
No, and that's a good point to bring up too. And that's where we got to find out, you know, more info as this keeps going on, since it's already changed once. Like we all said, we all woke up yesterday to reading about a DUI, and that's not the case of what happened here. So yeah, I'm with you. I really want to find out, you know, exactly how this happened. Is this, you know, the first time he's taken those and had a, because we don't know. We just don't know.
But here's the flip side of what I said. And again, sometimes you just kind of think these things through out loud, and I'm thinking them through with my mouth rather than my head now, because it just occurred to me. I might be wrong about even wondering about how long he's been taking this quote-unquote combination of drugs, because if memory serves, I was prescribed Vicodin, I want to say 8 to 10 years ago, for something or another that I was dealing with in some extreme pain. Might have been ear infections or something. But it was terrible. I couldn't work. I couldn't hear. I couldn't think. It was just terribly painful in your head when you got ear problems. Anyway, I was prescribed Vicodin once, and if memory serves, I think that drug alone, forget about mixing it with anything, it says right on the prescription label, do not operate heavy machinery, can and will cause drowsiness, that sort of thing. So if that's true, and Vicodin was, according to the reports, one of them, then the rest of that conversation is moot. He got behind the wheel of a car while on just one opioid, Vicodin, which can and does make one very drowsy. Now, does it make you completely unable to pass the field sobriety test? No. Now, we're in a different realm. He couldn't touch his nose. He couldn't walk the straight line and do the turn. He couldn't do the national anthem, all the different things. And I read it earlier today that there were four of them that they tested him on. He couldn't do those things. And I guess just being drowsy shouldn't make that, you know, all of those things the case, I would imagine, I guess. But it certainly, just the Vicodin alone would cause the reaction of perhaps falling asleep while sitting at a light or sitting in your car. And when he was found, by the way, his blinker was on and his brake lights were on, so clearly he had stopped the car, you know, at a light or wherever, and then just fell asleep while with his foot still on the brake. God, thank God it didn't come off.
Roll
forward, and who knows what you're going to hit. Or whom you're going to hit.
Even though it wouldn't have been that fast, still, yeah, I'm with you. Apparently, good thing that his foot never came off the brake, because, that could have been really bad.
So, I'm just picturing, you know, again, when I said I felt sorry for him, I'm just picturing him on the side of the road trying to do all these things. Here's a report. He was first asked to perform a walk and turn, according to the affidavit, but could not maintain starting position, missed heel to toe each time, stepped off the line several times, and used his arms for balance. He was then asked to perform a one-leg stand, was unable to raise his leg off the ground 6 inches, placing his foot down several times while he tried to complete the test. The finger-to-nose seemed to confuse him, who, despite having the instructions explained to him multiple times and claiming he understood what was being asked of him, failed to complete the task as ordered, according to the report. And then he also did not complete the horizontal gaze nystagmus. I don't even know what that is. Nystagmus. I've never heard that word before. I've got a pretty extensive vocabulary, but that one got me. Anyway, did not follow the stimulus, whatever that means. And then the fifth test went much better, it said. He completed the Romberg alphabet He did the anthem by reciting the national anthem backwards, though the report noted he did need the task explained to him several times. So he missed four, he failed four, and then did okay on one of the field sobriety tests. Just drowsiness, I wouldn't think anyway, would cause all that kind of impairment, but then you get into the mixture of the cocktail of drugs that he was taking at this particular time, and now we're back into a state of mystery. So anyway, that's where we are with Tiger Woods. Very briefly, because I only have 8 minutes before the top of the hour, I need to get into this Bryce Harper, Hunter Strickland bench clearing brawl crap yesterday. What is it about these San Francisco area teams that are just punks? You know, with the Warriors, I'm not kidding. What is it about these punks? They are just flat out punks. Oh, and by the way, here's another story to bring it kind of close to home here in Toledo. Did you see this story over the weekend, you guys? Former 49ers player Brandon Jacobs, who played for the Niners when, guess who was their head coach? Jim Harbaugh. Has vowed to get Jim Harbaugh fired from Michigan.
Good luck with that one.
Not joking. This is not, I'm tying this into the Bay Area thing here, but no kidding. He's called him out on Twitter. He said when he was the coach, he didn't know squat crap about offense. He said he didn't know. He's drawing cover twos up and running guys on slants directly into safeties, putting guys in harm's way. Terrible. And this went back and forth a little bit on Twitter. Brandon Jacobs challenging at Coach Jim 4UM, draw up cover six and post it. Oh, and don't ask any of your assistant coaches either. He's challenging him on straight up, simple pass patterns and defenses to see if he can actually do it. Now, obviously, and he did it again later. Harbaugh responded with biblical advice. Literally, biblical advice for at Gator Boy RB. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. So he's not getting into the, hey, here's what I know about offense. He's just kind of saying, knock it off, taking the high road, literally. Brandon Jacobs' response, draw cover 4-2. So he's just like, he's pretty confident in himself that Harbaugh didn't know defenses and didn't know what offenses to run into defenses. And thus put guys in serious jeopardy. And he said he is going to try to get him fired. He said he's going to continue. That's going to be his mission. Let me read that quote here real quick. Jim, I had a lot of respect for Jim when I was there before I got to know him. I enjoyed my time there, but we didn't see eye to eye. I knew a little bit more about football than he did. No, I'm sorry. I knew a little bit more about football than what they let on. Going somewhere where they don't have route conversions into certain coverages was just absurd. They're just running routes into the defense, getting people killed. Size and strength is what they had, and that's why they won. But let's be real. They had great assistant coaches, but Jim didn't know what he was doing. Jim had no idea. Jim is throwing slants into cover two safeties, getting people hurt. The guy knew nothing. Then the running back reiterated his dislike for Harbaugh on Saturday via Twitter, saying, quote, love the support, but stop the Super Bowl talk. I will expose him. Michigan will fire him when I am done. End quote. So he is coming for Harbaugh, which is a fascinating story. And I cannot wait to talk to some of our Michigan beat riders and guests up north of the state line to see what they have to say about all of this, because I think this is just a fascinating story. But I don't want it to detract from what I have with this Harper story. Hunter Strickland, we know the story by now. If you've been paying attention, you do anyway. Hunter Strickland faced Bryce Harper twice in the 2014 NL playoffs in the first round. Let me repeat. This was in 2014. For those keeping score at home, that was before 2015 happened, and that was before 2016 happened. We are now in 2017. So again, for the benefit of those scoring at home, that's over 2 years ago, roughly 2.5 years ago. Hunter Strickland gave up two absolute moonshots in the postseason to Bryce Harper. Now, those videos of the home runs that Harper hit are kind of circulating the web right now. Both of them are viral, at least in sports circles. And some might argue that he paused a little bit too long on the first one. And thus, according to the unwritten rules of baseball, so on and so forth, showed up Hunter Strickland because he paused. Listen, he hit one in the National Stadium to the third deck. It would have been impossible to hit that the way he hit it and not stopped and stared at it for a second to say, oh, my God, where's that going? You ever golf? Do you golf, Frank?
Yes.
You golf, Kush?
Oh, yeah, we've been a while, but yeah.
Yeah, we've been through this. You're a terror on the putt-putt courses. Okay. Frank, do you hit it pretty far?
Sometimes if I really get a hold of one.
You occasionally catch one, and you just stripe it right down the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Starts out low and begins to rise.
Oh, yeah.
And you know that I got all of that one. Do you immediately look down, or does your eye, do your eyes follow the flight of that ball, admiring its majesty?
Oh, I admire, because it happens so...
So rarely, right?
Yeah, so rarely. You have to admire and go, oh, that's probably the best one I'm going to hit all day. Let me crack open a cool one.
I'm
right?
The same way. And guess what? It is also rare that you're going to hit one to the third deck in a playoff game, no less. The idea that Harper would have paused for just a second longer before trotting out of the box and watching the flight of that son of a blank, nobody could fault him for that. Nobody. That's not showing up the pitcher. That's just, holy crap, where's it going? Oh, my God. Then the second one that he hit off of Strickland in the same postseason was another monster shot, not quite as high and as far to as the third deck. But this one was in San Francisco, right? And this one was right down the right field line. And this one was in doubt as it took off. Is it going to be inside of the foul pole or outside of the foul pole? Either way, it's probably going into McCovey Cove and landing in the water. But is it in or out? And as he stood there wondering, do I start trotting or is that a foul ball? Again, it looks like maybe he's showing him up, like he's admiring the drive. But I've watched that multiple times today because I am so pissed off at Hunter Strickland and every one of the cowardly San Francisco Giants who defend him, which, by the way, is not all of them. Buster Posey is my new hero. But Harper stood there watching. Is it fair or foul? Fair. Once he realized it's fair, he got off onto the trot. He didn't make it one of these 30-second loping soft strides around the bases, enjoying the atmosphere. And
he didn't do the Joey Bat flip.
Pissed off, right, making the pitcher all ticked off at him and everything. He ran around the bases relatively fast, by the way. It was a big moment. It tied the game. But nonetheless, little hurt feelings, Hunter Strickland didn't like that. So he didn't face him in 2015. Why did Hunter Strickland never face Bryce Harper in all of 2015? Probably pretty good reason. Because Bruce Bochy didn't want Bryce Harper to drive one to the moon off of him. He's only faced him twice in his career and both times gave up moonshots. So Bochy, the manager of the Giants, probably never had Strickland in when Harper was gonna bat. Same story in 2016. They never faced one another. So this is the first time that Strickland has faced Harper since those two moonshots in 2014. And we know the story from there. You've been listening to it all day. Listening to it all day. 98 miles an hour, straight into the hip. And you might say, well, that's where it's supposed to happen. All right, he got back at him. Got back at him for what? For doing his job? For swinging the bat and hitting the ball as far as he could? That's his job. You don't retaliate for somebody doing their job. There's no retaliation for that. Well, he threw it at the butt. That's where he's supposed to do those things. I don't care where he threw it. What if it hits him right in the pelvis and cracks it? What if his aim isn't perfect and it's a foot higher than the hip? What's that? What do you see right there? The lower ribs. What if he breaks one of Bryce Harper's ribs and costs him the next 2 months, 3 months of the season or more? It's a 98-mile-an-hour fastball with a rock, which is what a baseball is. It's a rock. Harper justifiably, absolutely came to the mound. He took the helmet off, wanted to fire a hard object back at him. How do you like it? Unfortunately, as he threw, it slipped out of his hand and went off to the side. And then they got there, and of course they exchanged some blows, and away we went. Harper had every right to be pissed. And the problem is, Harper is probably going to get a 5 or 7-game suspension for going to the mound and starting a fist fight. And Strickland is probably going to get the same thing. All right, everybody, it's all even. All's fair, love, and war. Everybody got. No, it's not fair. Because Harper would have played 6 or 7 games out of 7. Strickland would have pitched 1.
Well, he was a reliever, so it might be 2.
What's that?
He's actually a reliever, so it might be 2.
Okay, maybe.
Right.
Maybe, depending on who they're playing and who else hits bombs off of him.
Right.
But the point is, he should absolutely miss or be suspended, in my mind, 25 games, just to make sure that he misses at least five. And that's the way I treat it with starters. That's why I'm going by the starter routine,
right,
even though he's a reliever. 25 games to miss five games is exactly how it ought to be. Harper, honestly, should get nothing but a pat on the back. I'm getting tired of the cowardly pitchers, and that's what they are, throwing rocks, throwing lethal objects as hard as they can at batters, all especially. And I don't even care if there would have been a bat flip. Kiss my A. You don't want somebody to flip the bat after taking you into the cove? Then make a better pitch. Because you know what? If a DB doesn't want that quarter, that wide receiver doing a backflip in the end zone, don't get beat deep. When they beat you, they can celebrate. When you beat them, you can celebrate. Stop with the unwritten rules bullcrap. Stop with the gentleman's rules, gentleman's game, and all this other crap. Baseball players, particularly pitchers, are blanks. Words that I can't use on the radio. But the one I was going to use rhymes with wussies. That's what they are. And I give all of the credit in the world to Buster Posey, who knew full well that Strickland had no business throwing at Harper and did not even stand up and do what every catcher tries to do when there's a mound charge, and that is restrain the batter to give their pitcher a fighting chance. Posey stood there and said, "You threw at him, you dipwad. You deserve what he's bringing to the mound. I'm not coming to save you." Love Buster Posey for that. Got a lot more on that coming up. Bill Conley talking college football with us in a way that you won't expect. Coming up next, right here on The Ticket.
Austin Jackson with a drive to deep right field. Joyce back. It's over his head, and it's gone. Austin Jackson with an opposite field home run, his second homer of the year. And it gives the Indians a 1-0 lead. That is hammered. Goodbye. Deep into the seats in right field, and the Indians' lead is 2-0. Home run number 6 for Carlos Santana. And this ball's hit hard, deep center. Back is Rache. He's out of room. It's out of here. Way out of here. Up into Heritage Park. Encarnacion, home run number 10, and he's now hit in 8 straight.
And we talk so much about putting up a crooked number. It was 4, but I mean, it's those things are good. We see what happened. They hit 3 solos, but it wasn't enough. Now it got interesting at the end, but it wasn't enough. Thought we did some good things early.
There's the ground ball. Fair ball inside the bag at third. 2 runs will score. Iglesias and Avila have come in. It's going to be a double and 2 RBIs for Victor Martinez. Swing and a drive in the deep left field. Way back and gone. J.D. Martinez, a 3-run shot for the Tigers. And the offense has exploded here in the 5th. And it's going to get through. Here comes the runner on the plate. Throw time. There's a base hit to center field. 1 run scores. Here comes Iglesias to the plate. The throw, the tag, safe. A 2-run single for Miguel Cabrera.
A little bit of a roller coaster, but I think it was nice to see the bats perk up. A lot of guys up and down the line came up with some big hits. JD, Miggy, Presley, Iglesias, and get that all part of that rally. Justin Upton, get that thing going. So that was the real bright spot was the offense perking up.
Whoa! History. Bryce Harper wants a piece of Hunter Strickland. Here they go. Strickland lands a punch. Harper lands a punch. Bench is empty. And if that was unintentional, Hunter Strickland just totally lost his command.
We told you there was history, and it goes back to the playoffs a couple of years ago, and that was intentional in my mind.
Middle of the back with the hardest fastball he has.
I understand. There are ways to police the game, but an egregious act like this where some guy hits 2 home runs off me and I don't think I can get him out, so I'm just going to throw 98 at his hip. Why is this allowed? This isn't allowed in any other sport. Yeah, 20 games, unpaid, get into his wallet, and I think stuff like this will stop happening.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, rolling onward, a little late starting hour number 2 because we ended hour number 1 just a little bit behind, but I think it was worth the conversation. Thanks for being with us right here at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. All right, you know, during the college football season, we are often graced by the presence of our next guest. It is not college football season. It's not even spring football right now. We're actually in a down period. But my, oh my, are we glad to have Bill Connolly back. He, of course, covers college football for SBNation.com. And he has a new title, College Football Commissioner, at least in his world. That's what he wants to be. Mr. Commissioner, it is so good to have you right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket in Toledo. Welcome back, good sir. How are you?
Yeah, I mean, if you just declare it, I mean, until somebody says you're not, then you can just pretend like this is your new job. So that's
why
what I'm doing here.
And it's not like you just did this all willy-nilly. This was not just some little, you know, 750-word column. If I were commissioner, here's what I would do. My God, man, how much time did you put into this amazing presentation about fixing everything that everybody has ever griped about college football in the last 50 years?
Yeah, this went through a few different iterations over the last few months, really. You can tell from the election theme kind of maybe when it started, when we started to have the idea. But yeah, I mean, as it kind of, it took shape, we figured out some things to fix. We were able to tighten things over time, and I was really happy with the result.
All right, Bill, I'm just I want to cover as much of it as we can. Obviously, we don't have you all day. It took you months, and it could take us hours to discuss what you did over the course of months. And I'm just so very impressed by it, first of all. So let me just butter you up a little bit here first. and we'll talk about the specifics. But right there on the homepage of this, and by the way, I want everybody to see this. It's SBNation.com. Just search for a College Football Commissioner by Bill Connolly. And now, Bill, the coaches that you have speaking out there on the homepage, they are responding specifically to the idea of having a commissioner rather than having, you know, a group of presidents running the show, the conference
right.
commissioners and so on. So having a Roger Goodell type individual for all of Division I-A college football, or FBS as we come to know now, that's the goal here. And the response that you've gotten from some of the biggest names in the game, from Jimbo Fisher to Mark D'Antonio to Nick Saban, et cetera, they're all very positive about the idea.
Yeah, and I mean, in a way, when that many people are affirmative about something, you should maybe wonder about it in general. But I mean, I think head coaches, especially, from different conferences, different, even just the power conference universe, I think a lot of them, it's very easy to see how you would get frustrated by the fact that every single one of these conferences has their own set of rules in a lot of way. They're arguing right now in the SEC about what to do with grad transfers. There should just be a grad transfer option for, I mean, a universal rule, whatever that is. And it is really just odd. You know, college football is very unique in this regard. Other sports, I mean, you can find little examples, but just the massive degree of difference from conference to conference and subdivision to subdivision and everything else is crazy. And I think, you know, that's where the Jimbo Fishers and the Nick Sabans are coming from. We would like somebody to tell us, you know, what the rule is for everybody, not have to decide our rule for our little corner over here, and they can do whatever they want somewhere else.
It makes perfect sense, which is why, of course, none of this would ever happen.
That's, right, exactly.
That's how most great ideas are. They just kind of fall by the wayside because the people who are invested in the way current things are currently would never want to give up any of their power. Now, speaking of the word power, that was one of the first things I wanted to ask you, though. One of the problems that a lot of people have with Roger Goodell is that he does have too much power. One man should not have, overall disciplinary measures taken, et cetera, et cetera. Investigations that might be conducted, fines that are handed out, suspensions, the sole arbiter on who gets unsuspended from a ban, you know, like Josh Gordon type of thing. So would there be any worry in your mind that if there was one, you know, overarching college football commissioner, that he would have too much power?
Yeah, well, certainly, yeah. I mean, that's why we, in the platform we put together, we tried to avoid that kind of thing, the disciplinary actions for, and then, you know, the areas where the NCAA already has enforcement, obviously, if we follow our platform, overall, we're going to change a lot of rules. But the enforcement of those, I still think, you know, having that go through the NCAA kind of makes sense. This is, if done correctly, and as you said, you know, the odds of it being done correctly are not amazing, but if done correctly, then you can simplify matters for the NCAA, make their job a little easier, and make them better at the job they have.
Bill Connolly is our guest. He wants to be the commissioner of all college football. Now, outside of declaring yourself as such, probably not going to work. They're going to look for somebody that's within their own ranks.
Right, and that's where everything falls apart, too,
right.
Because that's, if it's just an insider who is already kind of pulling strings here and there, it kind of ruins the point in general.
Exactly right. Just like whoever's in charge of the college football
right.
playoff committee and so on and so forth, and before that, the BCS, et cetera. But be that as it may, if they did choose, you know, to do something like this, if they got together and said, yeah, this makes some sense, let's have the same rules for everybody and let's have one, you know, office kind of have everything run through that, how do you suppose they would decide?
You know, I mean, would it be one of these, you know, insiders that they already have on playoff committees, already had on BCS committees, et cetera? Would it be a current conference commissioner then kind of taking over? And I guess they would never be able to settle on anybody, because if you give it to the SEC commissioner, well, anything you do is going to benefit that conference. You know, all of the jealousy and the angerness and the anger and the bitterness would be there.
Yeah, I think there are certain names. Well, every time an article like this comes out, from ESPN or CBS or whatever, they say, here are the reasons why a commissioner would be a pretty good idea. And here are some names. Oliver Luck, some current head coach. I think there's a group of names that would be less objectionable overall, like a Nick Saban type when he retires, like an Oliver Luck who's held a number of different jobs in a number of different areas. Those are the types that would probably get approved. And again, that's, an insider running the show, it becomes kind of like Bud Selig being the commissioner of Major League Baseball. He was an owner speaking for owners, and that didn't really always work out very well for Major League Baseball.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, that's a great point, a great example on why not to. You know, I would almost think it would need to be a member of the media, whether it be a guy like you or, one of the longtime broadcasters who has truly proven to be somebody who has college football's best interest in mind. Mm-hmm. They didn't graduate from a Power Five conference school where they're going to have some sort of bias here and there. And they're just, and I don't want to give names, obviously, but you know who they are. You know who the longtime voices are who really truly have the best interest in mind. It seems like, one of those kinds of either broadcasters or writers who has not had an axe to grind, has no there's no way for him to benefit from this financially other than the salary that comes with the job. That it would just have to be that kind of a person.
Yeah, I mean, I'd vote for Vern Lundquist. That'd be fine.
there you go.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is, I think, that would be a better situation. I don't know if that's ever really happened to any degree. It's harder to come up with an analogy for that one, but that is the thought here. And you said for all of college football, that's kind of the most important part. I think that was one of the most unique parts of my quote unquote take on all of this, is that, we're complaining about a war on football. We're worried about the future of football, all these different things. Well, if you want to ensure a harder path for college football moving forward, then, this idea of the power conferences splitting up and in theory, I guess, everybody else becoming like an FCS, blah, blah, blah. If the money gets funneled more and more towards the top, the scholarship allotment is not as strong underneath it, then there are fewer opportunities to play college football. And if we're already worried about, health risks or, parents encouraging kids to play other sports and whatnot, then decreasing the opportunities to play the sport is the surest way to make sure that they look at other options. So it seems to me like the future of football depends on all of college football being healthy, not just the power conferences.
That's exactly right. That's what this is all about. So, Bill, let's get right into some of the specifics here of your proposal that you have put together. As Commissioner, Bill Connolly will redefine amateurism through a student-athlete bill of rights. Give us the thumbnail sketch version.
I think, we're on our way to that with the Bill of Rights thing. I think, the Indiana University has done one of those. Different schools have done that. I think we'll see that pretty soon, just in terms of guaranteed scholarships for a certain amount of time and, figuring out what to do, some sort of standardized way of figuring out healthcare options so that if you get hurt playing this sport in college, you're not saddled with massive financial burden afterwards. Make sure you're good from an insurance kind of standpoint. Those sort of things should be no-brainers. That should be very obvious. When the unionization thing popped up with Northwestern, I know we all took our political sides because of the word union, but the bottom line is a lot of the things they were asking for were things like this that everybody should have. And so, we don't need a union involved if we can get this enacted ourselves, I guess.
You talk about the need to redefine amateurism as well. Mm-hmm. What exactly are you talking about? You have the Olympic rings there, so I assume there's a connection.
I like the Olympic model. There are drawbacks and limitations with everything, but the Olympic model where you can make your money through endorsements and outside arrangements, so you're not working for the school. We always talk about, we just yell pay players, and that's kind of the end of our argument. Well, there are a lot of drawbacks. I think a lot of the power conferences especially could get away with treating the athletes as employees, but we don't necessarily have to do that. The market exists like it does for Olympics. There are drawbacks for it. I think it's still the cleanest way to make sure that the players who are making a particular amount of money for a given school are able to make some money as well.
Number three, as Commissioner Bill Connolly will, make recruiting fairer for everybody, especially the athletes. What's wrong with recruiting now?
I think, you know, honestly, I think some of the steps we've taken recently make it a little better. But, you know, what happens is we fix one problem, you know, we, you know, stick our thumb in a leak and another leak pops out elsewhere. Like this thing about banning, what is it, high school coaches affiliated with recruits from getting hired by a given school in a certain amount of time. Like that's great, but it also punishes good coaches in certain aspects, or banning coaches from driving recruits to camps when they could be, or to, you know, when they could be like paid to work at the camp or whatever. That's great, but then it increases the odds of, you know, the shady middlemen, the uncles and whatnot, getting involved and driving them instead. So, you know, I talked to Bud Elliott, our SB Nation recruiting analyst, for that part of the piece. There's a big long podcast in there for that, and I think you know, it's really not all that bad, or it's no. Like it can only be made so much better, I guess you could say. But, yeah, there are certain little measures like that that we can consider.
Where do you draw the line, though, on something like, you know, the first part of this? A mandate that schools automatically let a player go if a pre-specified coach, head coach, coordinator,
right,
or position coach leaves prior to, you know, the player or you know, the player coming to campus. What about the freshman or the redshirt freshman who is really,
yeah,
really liked by the head coach who recruited him or the position coach who recruited him, and he's in the plans for next year, but then he leaves after his redshirt freshman,
right,
year, and now he's stuck, maybe the new coach coming in is not such a fan of his and looking in a different direction, different type of style, blah, blah, blah. So is there, you know, is there a cutoff point here where, hey, you're in now and you've got to be in here for the duration of your career?
Well, part of the Bill of Rights idea kind of circles back around to that, where, you know, if you elect to transfer, there are, you don't have, one of the, I think the things that drives everybody crazy is this thought of the school being able to say, okay, well, you're transferring, you can't go to these schools though. That is one area where I understand from a coach perspective why you would want to be able to control that, but I don't really think it's fair to the athletes for a school to be able to control that. So yeah, if after your redshirt year, your coach leaves and you need to transfer, making sure your options are not limited as to where you can go, I think, is the way you handle that.
Bill Connolly is our guest. Bill covers college football for SBNation.com, and this is just a labor. Is this fair? A labor of love? Because the time that you had to have been enjoying this.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I mean, there are so many times I wanted to write a piece like that, and when, once you're in, something like this is in the works, you want to talk about it, but we tried as hard as we could to wait until it was all out to talk about it once, and that was tough a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, it's well worth the read, and as you point out, there's, you know, even podcasts in the middle of some of these sections to really kind of get much in much more depth. Than you can even in print, or in this case, online. Our producer, Jim Cushlin, is with us here as well, Bill, and he's got a question he wants to throw in. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, definitely. And by the way, guys, I've also posted a link to this on our 106.5 The Ticket Facebook pages. I'm loving all the fun details. I'm a nerd with some of this kind of stuff, so I'm encouraging everybody.
You could have stopped that sentence after the word nerd.
Exactly. one of my questions comes up with one of your topics. Most soccer people out there will know what the heck you're talking about, but if you're not full soccer, you may not know you have a pursue a promotion and relegation conference structure for all of NCAA football. Thumbnail sketch how that would actually work.
So yeah, we've written about that a few times at SBN through the years, and I mean the idea is simple. Like as I wrote in the piece, so much of our conference affiliations are based on who we were friends with in about 1932. And you know, if you were aligned with the right schools, you've been a power conference team your entire existence, even though you rarely do anything to actually earn that spot. And then there are the Boise's and the Toledo's and all these schools that have acted like power conference teams for most of the last, well, however many years. You're never going to be a power conference team no matter what you do, no matter how many good moves you make. And so, yeah, the idea of relegation that always appeals to me is just the merit aspect of this. You know, if Kansas stinks for an entire decade, why should they still get Big 12 money instead of Houston? You know, instead of the teams that actually go about making good moves and investing in the sport properly and treating their athletes right and putting a good product on the field, those should be the teams that are allowed to move up. So we've been running a – you can find the links in there. We've been running a simulation for a long time. We got another piece about it coming out soon. It's I understand that unless you have an all-powerful commissioner, it's not going to happen because nobody in a power conference would have any reason to say yes to such a thing. But in terms of the health of the sport, there would be nothing better, I think.
I completely agree with that. Bill Connolly joining us from SBNation.com. We're talking about the vision, his vision for college football. Let's talk about the playoffs. Because I think, you know, we all love the idea that we are now there, that the BCS is dead. We were 3 years into this thing. I think we don't necessarily like the fact that this committee is tasked with coming up with four when there may be five, six, seven, or eight teams that are certainly well worthy of playing for the championship. How expansive do you envision this?
No, I think Ben Boulware, he was a little melodramatic when he said it, but the Clemson linebacker before the title game or after the title game, right around the title game last year, basically said, you know, I would literally die if I had to play another game. Now, I don't think that's true, but it was a nice point in that, you know, we have to, if we're ever thinking about expanding to even six or eight, where, you know, you'd end up with a potential team playing 16 college football games, we do need to make sure they've got the Bill of Rights. We do need to make sure they're being properly compensated both in the present and the future tense. But once we do that, once we know that the athletes are better taken care of, then we can at least expand to eight. If we've got my relegation structure, then you could do five conference champions and three at large. If you, assuming that isn't in place, you do five conference champions, a group of five representatives, and two at-larges, and suddenly now, technically at the beginning of the season, everybody in FBS has a chance at the FBS title. Anybody in Group of Five right now just doesn't have that. Maybe one a year starts the season with a chance at the title. You know, it was Houston last year, and if they'd gone undefeated, they might have been able to sneak in, but, you know, that's not fair, and that's not part of a true national championship. And so I think eight teams would be fine. Yeah, obviously at that level, you go into 12 or 16 and you start to increase the odds of like a four loss conference champion or a national champion. But at eight, you pretty much are locked in on two losses most of the time at most. I can live with that. I think that seems to be the best balance.
Would we be talking about the five Power Five champions and then three at large, or would it be all at large based on rankings and the committee?
No, I would. Once we're to eight, I have no problem just saying all five power conference champions. So technically, at that point, you could have like a four-loss conference champion.
Yes.
But that would be very rare in recent history. But yeah, no, I mean that's, you know, everybody then has a pathway to a national title. I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, I do too. And you know, I got to respond to the Boulware comment. First of all, the idea that 16 games is going to kill somebody, but 15 isn't, I think is ludicrous. I think he probably feels that way after you play and you
right,
put everything
play Alabama.
Into. Yeah. You put everything into the two playoff games, the intensity, and then you know that this is the finale, and your entire being goes into this game. At the end, you probably do feel like, oh, my God, I could never play again. But if you knew that this was a semifinal and there was another one to come, you would feel very, very differently about that. And the reason it bothers me is because, you know, I look at even at the Division III level. You know, they've been playing 15 games a year, the two that go to the Stag Bowl, every year for the last couple of decades. You know, and obviously it's only the two that go to the Stag Bowl. And then the semifinals have only played 14. And before that, and there's 13 and so on and so forth. So we're only talking about two teams doing this per year where you might go to a 15th or a 16th game in this model. And if this is too much, Bill, again, why do we have to mandate that they play 12 regular season games? Why does that have to be, part of this puzzle?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't mind, among other things, getting rid of conference title games if we were to expand things in that regard. Now, if you get rid of title games, that makes tiebreakers nasty and weird, and so the title games are certainly clean in that regard, unless you're the Big 12 and you have a title game and you absolutely positively don't need one, but that's the Big 12. Oh, and by the way, Bob Bowlesby, that's another name that always pops up for these things, Boulware's comment in general, I liked it because it highlights the fact that, you know, another round would also make a ton more money for college football, and as things currently stand, no more would be invested in the players. And again, we don't have to go down the HR route, we don't have to go down the employing them ourselves route, but it would just make that kind of that divide even bigger. So if we address these other things first, I think eight teams is perfectly fine.
And I love, by the way, Bill, the dates, how you have it calendar wise, regardless of, you know, whether you're including the Group of Five, it doesn't matter. For the eight team, I love it because this is exactly how I've been doodling out in my head for seemingly forever now. You know, mid-December, you do a home road kind of quarterfinal. Then you go to the New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, kind of like they're trying to do right now with the semis, and then another week and a half. That's essentially the exact calendar that I've been doodling out when I've been thinking of eight teams. So I love how you're specifically saying, and then, yeah, having those games, regular season games, they always talk about meaning. Oh, the regular season means something. Yeah, you want to host that mid-December game
right.
in your yard, say.
Absolutely. Just
say
like the
Washington
game they do on some of the lower levels
State.
In college
yeah.
football now. That's, you know, that's one of the, that's one of the things that I don't understand why they're acting as if you can't have more playoff teams. These kids at these smaller schools, and at the, you know, FCS level and so on and so forth, guess what? They still go to classes. They still have finals. As a matter of fact, they don't have nearly as many resources as far as tutors and so
right.
on and so forth to help them get by that the big multi-million dollar Division I schools do, and they somehow find ways to graduate, et cetera.
Yeah, and, you know, and above all else, you know, this obviously with FBS, you've got the bowl structure too. I love, I mean, I think I've probably said on your show before, like, if there were 65 bowls, I would watch all 65. Like, that's, I'm all for more the merrier there, but, you know, technically, another round could kind of dilute certain bowl matchups a little bit. A, that's, I mean, you know, you live with it if you have a
sure.
playoff. And B, technically, the losers of the quarterfinals could 3 weeks later play in a January 1 bowl, too, if we wanted to set it up that way. Obviously, there's a consolation game aspect to that. I don't know if the teams themselves would really be interested in such a thing.
I doubt
but it.
It
would be on the table.
Yeah, it would be like somebody losing in the first or second round of the NCAAs and saying, okay, now go play in the NIT.
Right. But, I mean, that's the way football, you know, bowls in general were supposed to be the exhibition, the celebration of a season gone by and whatnot. So
right.
in that mindset, it kind of works, I guess.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, let's tie that into the next part of this about, because you mentioned you'd have to get rid of the conference championship games and then, you know, the tiebreakers. If you get rid of the divisions in conferences, there wouldn't be one anyway. It is just one of your next thing. Let's guide conferences toward a fair and more exciting schedule format by eliminating divisions. Give us the
right, and you could still have a conference title game at the end of it. But generally, what the idea there was is simply we always complain about, you know, Big East, Big Ten East being stronger than the West, the SEC West being stronger than the East, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Big 12 North back in the day versus the South. Like, that's always imbalance is very difficult when teams change over time. And so why do we have divisions? That's an antiquated idea when you can think of most schools, their absolute need rivalries can be addressed in three steps. Most of, you know, you can find schools that hate more than three teams, but if we give these 14-team conferences especially, you could have an eight-game conference schedule, not even nine, but just eight. You play your three permanent rivals, five other teams, you play the other five the next year, and you've played everybody in your conference in 2 years. They're messy tiebreakers, like a three-way tie at 7-1 where there hasn't really been a round robin. There's a lot of weird issues in there that you maybe just have to solve with playoff rankings or something, but I think, you know, you're solving four problems and adding one, that's still a net gain right there.
Absolutely right. Now one that I really find interesting is you say the games are too long. What are you proposing?
Well, I think that's the easiest one to address. There are certain college rules that kind of make college, like the pass, the clock stopping at incompletions, or after first down, I should say. But things like stoppages after first downs and incompletions, why is that a necessity 2 minutes into the game? Why wouldn't we be able to lop off a little bit of time by not stopping the clock for those matters until the last X minutes of the half, 5 minutes or three or six or whatever we decide? That right there is going to save you 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes of game time right there. But the bottom line is, I went to I live here in Columbia, Missouri. I went to a Missouri Eastern Michigan last year. That game was an absolute blowout and lasted over 4 hours. That was miserable. I understand that commercial breaks are something we can't really address. If we could, that's the first thing on the table. But I understand live sports are where all ad revenue comes from now. But there are little things like that, things that I don't think would change the spirit of the college game, that we could still change instead of, you know, the ideas of, you know, going to a 48-minute game or something like that. That seems a little more extreme to me than just not stopping the clock for an incompletion 2 minutes into the game.
Totally agree. Cut off any of the length of the quarters. I don't want to go to 15 to 12 or anywhere else. That's the high school game. I think you still go to 15.
Yeah,
but you're
no,
right. There are a lot of ways just to speed the game up. Where it's not going to actually impact the players themselves. It's really only going to impact the number of hours that they're out there on the field.
Right, exactly.
Which would certainly be a better thing. Okay, so Bill, last thing, I love it. I think the amount of time, and you've tried to cover almost every eventuality. Well, they're going to complain about this. Here's the response to that. This is going to be, did I miss it, or did you not cover actual compensation for the players?
That one, basically, I left that as an if. Like, if we decide to go that route instead of the Olympic model, I think the Olympic model would address most of it. Because, I mean, among other things, you know, I think it's Andy Staples from Sports Illustrated who likes to say, you know, only a certain number of players are truly worth like a Stanford education, right? And, you know, some of them getting a scholarship, maybe it's more reflective of their level of contribution. But the stars who could get money elsewhere, if we let that kind of that market take shape, again, obviously issues arise, but I kind of like that more than paying the players themselves. If we want to go that route, I think, especially at the power conference level, we could. But I like this route a little better, I think.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's much better this way because, quite frankly, there are, you know, if you do this for college football, you know with Title IX, this is going to have to be done for other sports, particularly female sports, where stipends
right.
or salaries or whatever. And they're going to be in sports that do not generate any revenue for the program or for the school, I should say. In fact, suck the revenue up that the football team and the men's basketball team brings in, and that causes even more problems,
and,
I think. Than
and at the same time, this would open the door, too, for a star volleyball player or a star women's basketball player or something like that to make money as well. You know, I always hate it when people just say, let the market decide, but in this case, that kind of is what I'm saying, I guess.
Right, yeah, yeah, you are. You are, in a sense. But you know what? I love, like I said, that you know, you really kind of covered almost every area there is. What kind of reaction have you gotten? This came out, what, about a week ago, right?
It was good. We saw that we were getting traffic from Reddit, so I took a deep breath and followed it over there. The response is like 50-50, which is like 90-10 for anywhere else. So
you've never really arrived until you've arrived at Reddit, right?
That's right.
That's fantastic. Well, Bill, listen, I appreciated every word of this. I love the work that you put into it, and I really appreciate you coming on to explain it a little bit more as well. I just wish that it wasn't as much for fun, and please don't take that dismissively.
Oh, I know what you're saying.
But I mean, it's entertaining as hell to me. It makes great sense to me, and I wish that it would make some sense to the, you know, the Bob Bowlesbys of the world and the people, you know, to actually get somebody who actually cared. Conference commissioners, you know, university presidents, et cetera, chancellors. I really wish they would entertain this kind of an idea because it really would be for the betterment of the kids, you know, the college players themselves, the students, everybody would benefit if we had these common sense reforms and obviously a commissioner to institute them all.
Agreed.
Bill, great work, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to catching up with you again sometime around early September when you get the season going and we'll talk again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill. Bill Connolly, SBNation.com. I tweeted out the link to this wonderful piece that he put together that he worked on for months. And by the way, just to be fair to everybody, I should probably credit his team because he credited his team on the page. He's the author, but his editors are Elena Bergeron and Jason Kirk. Photos were provided by James Barham, development Graham Macquarie, and design Tyson Whiting. So it was a team effort, obviously, there at SBNation.com. So check it out. It's on our Twitter feed right now. Jim, did you say you put it on Facebook,
that
too?
That is correct. I put a link to it on our Facebook page at 106.5 The Ticket.
So Facebook is 106.5 The Ticket. Look for that. Twitter, it's Sports Radio 106.5. Sorry about the dueling handles there, but that's just the way that it goes. So check those out and read it for yourself and maybe even talk about it later on the program, even if it's later on this week. All right. We're going to get a quick timeout here. I want to remind you, by the way, that ESPN 106.5 The Ticket and Michigan International Speedway, we're offering a chance for you to win tickets to each event at the MIS the weekend of June 16th. To qualify, text MIS ticket, the letters MIS for Michigan International Speedway, ticket, to 64636. All right, text to 64636, the phrase MIS ticket. Good luck to you from Michigan International Speedway and Toledo's ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. We'll come right back, try to get some calls in, hit a few more items before we're done. Turn it over to Drive Time coming up at the top of the hour right here.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5, The Ticket.
All right, 866-240-1065, final segment of the broadcast this Tuesday afternoon. Hope you had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Did you celebrate with some barbecue, Jim Cushlin?
Indeed we did. Went up to see the relatives, got a couple games, did some barbecue, and we did the whole thing.
Yeah, very nice. What about you, Mr. Gargano? What did you do for the holiday?
Yep, grilled some burgers, some brats, and had some cool ones, so it was a pretty successful weekend.
Outstanding indeed, and I'm sure we all took some time to remember exactly why we were off the air yesterday and why We do indeed celebrate the liberty that we enjoy each and every day, thanks to those who gave their lives. And we honor them, of course, each and every Memorial Day weekend. We should do it more often than that. But I just wanted to make sure we got that in there on the back end, as we talked about it on Friday on the way into the Memorial Day holiday. So, you know, the idea, just to kind of follow up a little bit on Bill Connolly and his idea. I mean, it was so in-depth. It was so well researched, and I think that's the most important thing. You know, in talk radio sometimes, and even columnists who are lazy, they'll sit there and just fling out, oh, they ought to do this. I think they ought to do that. Never trying to answer the question, how are you going to pay for this? What about the consequences of that? It's just, this is what I think we ought to do. And it's lazy, and again, we do it in talk radio. I try not to do it very often. I try to make sure I have some well-researched information before I offer an opinion on something, but it happens, and certainly columnists do too. He researched everything, every eventuality, every potential drawback, talking about the paying the players versus the Olympic amateurism, talking about the conference realignments or getting rid of the divisions, having the pod type of scheduling where every team will play three teams every year because of rivalries, geographical or history or otherwise. I mean, literally everything was covered, but the key would be implementing a commissioner type of overseer to, you know, delegate responsibilities, I guess, to make all of that possible and to make all of that happen. And he's, as he said, even if, you know, the powers that be were to kind of come together and say, you know, it does make some idea or make some sense. It's a pretty good idea for us to consolidate power under one roof in one office, rather than the SEC has these rules. The ACC has these rules. The Big Ten has these rules. We have a conference title game. We don't, blah, blah, blah. It ought to make some sense to kind of regulate everything and consolidate power under one roof. But as Bill said, if we did, it's going to be one of them. And that in and of itself is going to create conflicts. It's going to be one of the conference commissioners who is then going to be accused, fairly or not, justifiably or not, of, you know, instituting rules that favor his boys, his good old boys. And then you're going to have to look into the possibilities of, you know, pay to play, if you will. You know what I mean? Given money, it's like politics. Given money to get along and to get favors, that sort of thing. They'll never accept an outsider. It'll always have to be somebody from within their power block. And the reason why is only choosing somebody from within your power block do you guarantee yourself that you maintain some of the power. Because I got influence over that guy. He's one of us.
Right.
You get an outsider. Like I said, you know, get one of the great voices of college football from years gone by, or even now, even studio guys. You know, a John Saunders or somebody, I don't know, a great college football advocate who doesn't have, you know, an axe to grind, money to make, favors to grant, et cetera, that is just interested in the right thing for the players, for the universities, for the coaches, the recruits coming up, et cetera. If it was somebody like that, I think it would be a great idea. But I guess until you and get them to come, you know, to come along. When I say they, I'm talking about the commissioners, et cetera, of the conferences and university presidents. Unless you get them to come around to your way of thinking, it's all just pie in the sky.
No, and it kind of is, and that's obviously the one biggest, probably real life hurdle to getting something like this implemented or even talked about, because you're going to have obviously those issues. Because you're 100% right. They would want somebody, you know, from the inside. I want to go back to something that, you know, you're talking about how well researched this thing is. You know, perfect example. I'm reading one little paragraph right now. This is in the scrapping divisions part, right? And, you know, just looking at this paragraph, and I'm thinking, yeah, it would even take me a little while just to find out this information. Here's a little snippet of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Quote, under the current format, former rivals Auburn and Florida haven't played since 2011. People born on the day of that game would be in middle school the next time the Gators played at Jordan-Hare in 2024. Newer SEC additions, Texas A&M, hasn't played at Kentucky since 1953 and won't do so again until 2025. Wow. It would take me probably an hour or two just to find those pieces of info. So when we tell you how well researched this whole thing, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why he said it took months. This is one of those projects where somebody, like, you know, takes several months off of their regular job to write a book.
Yeah,
because essentially he's written a book here is what this is, and instead of making it, you know, 900 pages long, They put some of it in print and included some of it in podcast.
Yep.
Vote the spoken word as opposed to the written word here, just for the purposes of time and resources, et cetera. It makes sense to listen to it as well. So I encourage when I tell people to go to our Twitter feed and our Facebook page and find this, which we sent out. Don't just read, but seriously, click play. Some of it is worth it. Now, you got to spend some time. You just spent 2 hours listening to this show, roughly, and one of the pieces includes a podcast that's about an hour and 55 minutes long as well.
Right.
But so, I mean, you really got to be devoted to this, but I really, really, truly think it's worth the time, even if it's just for a great conversation.
Absolutely.
And really, at the end of the day, it is just for conversation because it's never going to come to fruition. All of the great ideas, or many of the great ideas that a lot of people have, end up just dying on the vine because somebody doesn't want to sacrifice their own power, their own wealth, et cetera, in order to make something better, possible. So I guess that's where we're going to have to leave it. I've got a lot more thoughts on Buster Posey, my new favorite catcher. Got a lot more thoughts on Bryce Harper and Hunter Strickland from the unwritten rules nonsense that continues to go on today. I really wish Bryce Harper had not lost control of that helmet when he flung his arm and it slipped out of his fingers. I wish he would have bashed Hunter Strickland right upside the head with it and really send a message, hey, pitchers, think twice before you do this, because we're all coming out. And maybe bat in hand, if not helmet in hand. You want to throw rock-hard objects at us 95, 98 miles an hour, we're going to throw rock-hard objects at you. Might not be able to fire him 98, we're going to come closer. And then let's see if you have such a willingness to throw inside on me next time. I would love to see that be the new norm. I just really wish Harper had not lost control of that helmet. People are kind of having fun with the throw. It wasn't a throw. I mean, it's not like he was, you know, Barack Obama throwing an opening pitch to the backstop wide by 17 feet. It's a helmet. He was holding it by the brim of it, and it slipped out of his fingers as he tried to fling it. But I really, really wish he had hit him so that people kind of, when I say people, I'm talking about wussy pitchers. And they are. They're wusses. All of them, so that they would think twice before they start throwing rock-hard objects at guys in the future. More on that tomorrow. Coming up next, Drive Time right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, Mike Miller, not in today, but the show is in the capable hands of Messrs. Cushlin and Gargano. So stay where you are right here on The Ticket. We'll see you.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep their trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.